All right. Art has been a bit of a theme. This isn't really an art thing, but we'll get there. Does anybody know what this, not this, but yes, this image is from? What comes to mind for anybody? Holy cow. Okay. I thought I'd have like a 10% hit rate. That's wonderful. Oh, this might land. Okay, this is famously from Narnia. This is the first image that the Pevensey children see in the Chronicles of Narnia. So the Chronicles of Narnia is a fantasy series written by C.S. Lewis with these beautiful themes woven through it that often get mentioned in sermons. And so buckle up, you're getting a lot of C.S. Lewis today. So the Pevensey children go through the wardrobe, and this is what they first encounter. And the entire Chronicles of Narnia begin with essentially the question, why is there winter in Narnia? Why is there winter in Narnia? In fact, the phrase that the children are told is that it's always winter, but never... My goodness, guys. Always winter, but never Christmas. And so why is there winter in Narnia? Why is there sort of this reality that pervades everything that the world is not quite as it should be? Why are the seasons not changing? Why is spring not coming? Why is summer never arriving? Why is it winter in Narnia? And if you know the stories, which apparently many of you do, your first thought might be of who? Who's the central figure in the Chronicles of Narnia? Aslan, right? The big lion. And in one of the very first scenes in the Chronicles of Narnia, I'll read this for you. Susan, one of the Pevensey children, says, "Who is Aslan?" asked Susan. "Aslan," said Mr. Beaver, there's talking animals in the Chronicles of Narnia, "why don't you know? He's the king. He's the lord of the whole wood. Not often here, you understand. Never in my time or my father's time, but word has reached us that he has come back." So the Chronicles of Narnia begin. By the way, this is going somewhere. If you guys are like, what are we doing right now? We'll get to Romans. Don't worry. So it begins with these children coming into through the wardrobe and into Narnia. And then there's this conversation between Susan and Mr. Beaver. But the word has reached us that he has come back, that Aslan has come back. He is in Narnia at this moment. He'll settle the White Queen all right. He'll put all to rights, as it says in an old rhyme in these parts, "Wrong will be right when Aslan comes in sight. At the sound of his roar, sorrows will be no more. When he bares his teeth, winter meets its death. And when he shakes his mane, we'll have spring again." And so part of the answer is that Aslan has not been around Narnia. But as the story continues, what you learn is that one of the reasons why Aslan isn't there is because of the absence of the children themselves. In fact, it's the presence of the children in Narnia that draws Aslan to suddenly be back on the scene. So, one of the other little girls, Lucy, asks, well, what can we do about this? What can we do about winter in Narnia? "The quickest way you can help is by going to meet Aslan," said Mr. Beaver. "Once he's with us, then we can begin doing things. Not that we don't need you too, for that's another of the old rhymes. When Adam's flesh and Adam's bone sits at Cair Paravel enthroned, the evil time will be over and done." So the Chronicles of Narnia have this really interesting understanding of what's happening, of why there's winter, which is, yes, Aslan's not around, but there's a more fundamental problem, which is that the four thrones in Cair Paravel, which is the capital of Narnia, are currently unoccupied. And what they're waiting for are true sons and daughters of Adam, and in other places, sons of Adam and daughters of Eve to sit on those thrones. And so the first book, Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, or the first movie, you can go watch this movie on Disney Plus, ends with this scene. So here are your four thrones, Cair Paravel, the capital city, and here are the children. At the end of the first book, the children actually come to reign as kings and queens of Narnia. And then the rest of the series is about them, alongside with Aslan's help, putting to right all that's gone wrong in Narnia. What in the world does that have to do with Romans 8? Well, C.S. Lewis was a Christian writer and thinker, one who actually came to that much later in life. He was a medieval literature professor and an extraordinary one at that. And when he became a Christian, he suddenly realized there's this thread in all of these old tales that I'm reading that actually resonate to, that have whispers and echoes of the true Christian story. And for him, the Christian story, he called it the true myth. Not in the sense that it was, you know, made up, but like it's the truth, capital T, and that's why all these stories have whispers in it. And so he himself then set out to write his own version, his own story, with these Christian themes weaved in. And that nuance, that both Aslan's absence, but also the need for true sons and daughters of Adam and Eve to sit on these thrones, is a deeply, deeply biblical and Christian idea. And I don't think that there's a better passage that captures that than what we'll talk about today. So let me just read this to you. This is Romans 8, where today we're going to be in 17 to 21. I'm overlapping a little bit with what Jalen preached last week because I think the thoughts go together. So this is from last week. The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs. Heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, provided we suffer with him, in order that we may also be glorified with him. I don't know about you, but I was thinking about a couple things that from Jalen's sermon last week from this text. Man, I was thinking all week about, remember when Jalen was saying that this whole idea that the Spirit bears witness with our spirit is, it's like the Spirit is constantly telling us, hey, you should go talk to Dad. Like, this thing that you're going through, this thing that you have concern, go talk to Dad. Go talk to that. Why are you not using the resources that you have at your disposal? Why are you not moving into the relationship that could actually address this, both in your own heart, but also maybe in the world? Like, go talk to Dad. I was thinking about that and leaning into that all week. I don't know if it was Jalen's voice. I think it was the Spirit's voice, you know. but I kept thinking that all week. But this next verse is interesting. And if children, then heirs. No, go back, Mike. If children, then heirs, heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ. So this is saying if you're a child of God, then you're also an heir. And you're an heir in the same way that Jesus is an heir. You know what an heir is? Yeah, like an heir, but specifically, right? A child and an heir have two different nuances. Yeah, it's about an inheritance. It's someone who has an inheritance waiting for them. So what this verse kind of begs is the question, wait, what are we set to inherit? What is this getting at in terms of where heirs, what are we heirs of? And we might generalize that and say, oh, all of the wonderful things that come with salvation, but I actually think that there's a more specific inheritance that Paul has in mind here. But then there's also this little qualification at the end. Provided we suffer with him in order that we may also be glorified with him. So it does seem like there's some condition here that in order to be an heir, in order to get this inheritance, there has to be a willingness to suffer something somehow in order that we might then also receive whatever he means here by glory. Next week we'll talk a little bit more what he means by glorified with him. Okay, so it kind of sets the question. Okay, here's our text for today. Next slide, Mike. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willing, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. I just want you to sit with that. Think of Narnia and think of what Paul is actually saying here. First thing we've learned to do with Paul is look for our connecting words, right? And so go to that next slide. So the very first line here is building off of what he's just said. So we're inheritors of something with Jesus insofar as we are willing to suffer with him in order that we might be glorified with him. For, Paul says, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. We've seen this, interestingly. Do I need to do anything, Dean, with that little, I hear that click. I know you guys hear that click. No? Should I switch out, do you think? Think I'm all right? Yeah, okay. We've seen this. If you think of how Romans 8 started, it started with, there is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ. And then he sort of, the next two or three verses actually explain that in a way that's a little different than how we would think of building that argument. Do you remember this? It was like, he says, basically to be super short with it, like, Jesus died for your sins, gave you the Spirit. That Spirit is now turning you into someone who is actually being faithful to the covenant. Therefore, there is now no condemnation. So he like tells you the outcome of all of this stuff, but then he kind of tells you where it comes from. It's a little different than how like your English teacher would have taught you to compose an essay. So here he's giving us at the outset again, the conclusion of all of this is when I compare what's coming with what's present now, man, give me what's coming, and it really puts in perspective what I'm suffering now. Okay, how did he get there? The rest of this passage is how he gets there. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. Okay, so creation is a very interesting image. This is where Narnia comes in. Creation is on tippy toes, waiting, going, when are the children of God going to be revealed? When are the true sons and daughters of God? When are they going to show up on the scene? Because when they show up, things will go well for us in nature. That's the image that he's trying to create for us. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it. Now, this is probably verse 20 is the beginning of his argument in the way that we think of this. So Paul says you got to go back to creation, where God put in a certain order to how things would function best. And within that order, God creates the world, but then hands it over to humanity and makes us stewards of that world. This is essentially what it means to be made in the image of God, is that that's a responsibility that we're given as human beings. As we'll see next week, this is what Paul primarily has in mind when he talks about glory being given to us, is that glory is really about our role as stewards of creation. That goes horribly wrong when humanity decides we don't want to do things because what a steward does is that you rule and you operate under, in submission to, a superior. And so we were always meant to do things in the way that God said, but we said, first our first parents, and then each of us in turn say, I kind of want to run my life the way that I want to run my life, right? We've talked a lot about this. This is where the flesh comes in. This is where sin, capital S, comes in. But what Paul is emphasizing here is not only does that have consequences for humanity ourselves, it has consequences for the creation that we were meant to be stewards of. So creation itself suffered. The way that he describes that is he says it was subjected to futility. What this phrase here basically means is that creation, because humanity was no longer who we were meant to be, creation itself was subjected to that reality. You see, creation was always a project meant to be completed by humanity. It was raw materials that were meant to be used by God's stewards to create something amazing and beautiful. And humanity at its best, that's what we do. That's what beautiful art is. That's what good parenting is, right? You've been handed something, and to use it in a way that actually reflects God's goodness and purposes in the world, not only is that humanity at its best, that's creation flourishing as well. But by and large, what Paul is telling us here is that creation instead has been subjected to the sense of, this word futility means, to the sense of meaninglessness, to the sense of, well, I guess that's it for us. I guess this project isn't heading anywhere after all. Let me read to you what one theologian says about this. The effects of sin touch all of creation. No created thing is in principle untouched by the corrosive effects of the fall. Whether we look at societal structures such as the state or family or cultural pursuits such as art or technology or even bodily functions such as sexually or eating or anything at all within the wide scope of creation, we discover that the good handiwork of God has been drawn into the sphere of human mutiny against God. It is one of the unique and distinctive features of the Bible's teaching on the human situation that all evil and perversity in the world is ultimately the result of humanity's fall, of its refusal to live according to the good ordinances of God's creation. Human disobedience and guilt lie in the last analysis at the root of all troubles on earth. Why is there winter in Narnia? Essentially because humanity is not who we were meant to be. That's at the root of all troubles on earth. That's what Paul is getting at here in these verses. Notice, though, that subjection to futility by God, because this is the way that God set things up. This is where I find the Narnia thing helpful, is that Aslan is absent only because the way in which Narnia was meant to work, it's impossible without humanity's presence there, is basically what we're getting. So Aslan will not himself rule except in the way that he was always intended to rule, which was through true sons and daughters of Adam. That's the idea. That's what Paul is saying here. Of course, that's what C.S. Lewis is picking up on, not the other way around, right? Like, but this was done. So the fact that creation itself was subjected to futility, this was done in hope that that would not always be the case. And that's what Paul now says, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. So all of this happened in the sure hope that this would not always be the case. You see, one day creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption. The "its" there is picking up on the fact that who have we already been told is in bondage to corruption and decay, to sin and death? We ourselves, right? I'm talking about what have we been told in Romans 8 already, right? He's saying that will happen when the children of God, really the way that this reads is something more like the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and into the freedom that will come when God's children are glorified. Does that make sense? This is just an incredible thing. It means that humanity goes first in redemption. It means that we are the ones that creation sort of adapts itself to. Or maybe better put, when we become who we are meant to be by just the deep magic of the world, as they say in Narnia, all of creation will be transformed and renewed into what it's meant to be. This is just an extraordinary truth, right? Like, I think most of us, and so, let me say this. So, starting back, Paul says, when I think about all that, when I think, like, that's where this whole thing is headed, I think, verse 18, I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. If that's where this whole thing is headed, man, it really puts in perspective what we're going through now. Now, we'll talk a lot about this over the next couple weeks. What does this mean for suffering? What does this mean for the difficult things that we go through? But suffice to say for now, Paul is at least saying unapologetically something that we, sort of our ilk of Christian, Western, evangelical, if that means anything to you, not in a political sense, in a theological sense, we sometimes back away from what Paul is trying to push us into here, which is it's really hard to think too much about where this whole thing is headed as a follower of Jesus. And we need to think about it more. And this is where, like, some of the old hymns that talk a little bit more about where we're headed are really helpful. And I wonder if it's because in our sort of modern, naturalistic, sort of scientific era, the whole idea that creation will be utterly transformed, that this world will not always be how it is because we will not always be how it is. I wonder if we're a little embarrassed of that. And Paul's saying, embarrassed of that? That's your hope. Like, that's what this whole thing rests on, is that this is actually headed somewhere. And so think about that. Ponder that. Sometimes when, first of all, what this clearly doesn't mean is that creation's destiny is to be burned to a crisp while we are carried off into a disembodied heavenly existence eternally. Right? Like, if you've been around church or not, maybe you have this conception that when Christians talk about heaven, what we're talking about is, you know, life on a cloud in a harp in, you know, a toga or whatever. And you're kind of like, you know, but I really like coffee, you know, like, but, you know, I'd rather like a Thursday night, you know, watching football or something. Probably not Thursday night football. Those games are rough. But you take my point, right? Like, that is not the Christian hope. Even though, if you know that that's not your hope, and hopefully, my goodness, if you're around our little church long enough, hopefully you know that that's not it. We talk about this a lot. But even so, I think sometimes we think that our hope is in the transformed world, and then you and I, more or less as ourselves, get to enjoy this transformed world, which is pretty great, right? Like, I'll take a transformed world. But what Paul is reminding us is that our greatest hope is also creation's greatest hope, which is that what primarily needs to happen is you and I need to be transformed. And I think that this is where Paul would have us ponder. Can you imagine your life apart from the temptations that wage war with your soul? Can you imagine your life without the petty distractions that are just so difficult to set aside to care about the things that matter most? Can you imagine this world without the harm that you can experience at others' hands, without the woundedness that you've experienced because of other people's sin? Can you imagine a world in which injustice is not more the norm than not? Can you imagine a world where you don't scroll, you know, whichever way on your phone and you see the devastation just right now, just all over the world in warfare? Can you imagine waking up and it's not election season and it's not this partisan nonsense that we're in right now, right? And that your own heart isn't drawn into that? Can you imagine the things that, right, this is where we talk about this in discipleship, that often our deepest desires are not our strongest desires. That makes that makes following Jesus really hard. Because we know, oh, I want to be someone who longs for this is what we talked about at Men's Retreat, that longs for the presence of God more than the presence of my Instagram feed. That sounds absurd, but it's like, that's where I'm at, right? So many of us, right? I know that what I actually want to be is someone who cares for others. Because, man, when I do that, when I step outside of myself, we were talking about this in ministry, like, those are the best days of my life. Those are the days where I put my head on the pillow and I'm like, man, I did something today. And yet I still long for a Saturday where my schedule is free and I just veg out for 9 hours and I put my head on the pillow and go, ugh, what did I do today? What? Right? Because the stronger desires are here and those deep desires are just warring against. And Paul says, yeah, man, that's your flesh. That's the world. That's the enemy. One day, boom, that lid will be off. And those deep desires will be who you are. It'll just be who you are. And those scars and that woundedness is, I love the image in Revelation that literally is the hand of God that will be placed on them, that will wipe those tears away, that will heal those wounds, that whatever your sickness is, whatever thing that you've lived with, whatever has kept you, and you just know it's keeping you from being everything that God would want you to be, can you just imagine that lifted in a moment? And Paul says, when I consider the glory to be revealed, it really puts in perspective what I'm going through now. Notice that, so what are we to inherit? We started that question with. This is audacious, but it's what the scripture, we're to inherit the world, guys. It's what God intended from the beginning anyway, right? We were always meant to be stewards of this world. He handed us the world in the beginning, and he's longing to do it again. But those thrones are empty right now. But what he's longing for is for true sons and daughters of his to take their rightful place and to rule the world as it was meant to be. But the first work that needs to happen is we need to be transformed. Now, here's what Paul said in the previous passage. He says that that is, in a way, contingent on our willingness to suffer with Jesus now. Do you know what he's saying? Because so much of the suffering that we experience is us being transformed in a world that is not yet fully transformed and in bodies that are still not yet transformed. And so that includes a certain measure of suffering that will just characterize faithfulness now. I think that that's primarily what he has in mind about suffering with Jesus. He's not talking about the random stuff that happens to us, just circumstantially life is hard. He's talking about that faithfulness here and now, by definition, is suffering because everything, the winds are blowing against us. One day they'll be at our back, but right now they're in our face. And he says, but it's worth it because every step against the wind of my flesh, of the enemy, of the world system, every step is a step closer to glory that I'm moving toward. And here's the beautiful thing. Every step in that creation, right? Like this is the image. I'm not a good enough artist and I can't come to the women's night, so I can't become a better one. But I'm not a good enough artist. But the image that comes to mind is like the wind is blowing in our face. But every step of faithfulness, as difficult as it is now, it's like that next little cube of creation goes, oh, thank you. Thank you, right? Because creation is not just revealing. Paul's grid is always already not yet. It's all of this isn't at the end. Paul has a category for, and this is starting now. That creation is going, another one put their faith in Jesus. Ooh, there's a Christian who's living into the stuff that they're being called to in discipleship course. And it's like that next step, creation goes, oh, it's happening. There's another one over there. There's another one over there. There's faithfulness. These parents who stood here, they prayed over these kids and they want them to follow Jesus. And it's like creation is on tippy toes rejoicing at that, going, it's happening, guys, it's happening. That's the image that's being gotten at here. If I could make you walk away with three things, it's the undeniable significance of creation and the purposes of God. That the way that we handle and care for creation, it matters profoundly. Because we are not sort of unique among sort of predominant worldviews, especially religious worldviews. We are a this-worldly faith. Now, Christianity, I don't know why, especially in America, has become this like, let it burn. That's not biblical. We are a this-worldly. We Christians should care about creation. Should care about how it's handled, should care about, right, like part of what's wrong with our relationship with creation is I'm talking about, yes, ecologically and creation care and those kind of things, but also the way that we mishandle the stuff that has been given to us. We make those into idols. That's another sermon for another day, but that's partially what he's getting at here is like, man, we totally misuse this stuff. It's like the raw materials of creation, if they could speak back to us, are like, this is not what I was created for the record. But so all of that matters. Secondly, though, is that there is an even greater significance of humanity that this speaks to. That there is something unique about humanity. Let me let C.S. Lewis have this one as well. He says this, "It is a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses, to remember that the dullest, most uninteresting person you can talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship, or else a horror and a corruption such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare." This is how he lands that. All day long, we are, in some degree, helping each other to one or the other of these destinations. It is in light of these overwhelming possibilities, it is with the awe and the circumspection proper to them, that we should conduct all of our dealings with one another, all friendships, all loves, all play, all politics. Hello. There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. It is immortals whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit, immortal horrors or everlasting splendors. Isn't that an extraordinary thought? Significance of creation, the greater significance of human beings. And yet what this text really speaks to is the ultimate significance, the unsurpassed significance of Jesus himself. that he is the one who made this possible. He is, right now, sitting on the throne of heaven. There is a human being. God wants more. He wants far more. What Paul will say later is that we are being conformed into the image of Jesus such that Jesus would be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. The idea there is Jesus is sitting on the throne. We got a human being. We got one. And he is changing the world as he is. And he's welcoming us to join him. And he's saying these creation will be right when sons and daughters of Adam sit on these thrones. But he has gone before us. And the image that we're to leave the New Testament with is that what God did in raising Jesus from the grave was the prototype of what he will one day do for each of us individually and for all of creation. That's how extraordinary Jesus is we have a literal microcosm, right? That means a mini world. We have a microcosm of new creation in the face of Jesus himself. If I had to end where I began, I would say, yes, Narnia is significant. And the fact that there's winter in Narnia is a problem that needs solution. The Pevensey children, you and I, are a huge part of that. And God will not do it apart from our participation. And yet still, that doesn't make us the heroes of the story. Because if the hero of Narnia is ultimately Aslan, the hero of this world is not you and I. Praise God it's not you and I. It is Jesus himself who went before us, who bore the full weight of sin and death, who became in himself the very source of new creation. And now we are invited to join him with that, to be co-inheritors of what he alone deserves and yet freely gives to us.